Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, wherever it is you are listening from. This is the host of AI and the Future of Work, Dan Turchin, bringing you another conversation with a fascinating technology leader. These are interesting times. They're challenging for all of us. Like you, me, and our guests are self-quarantined, but here to discuss some of the interesting implications that self-quarantining has for the technology community, for us as individuals, maybe perhaps even for our families. Couldn't be happier than to be joined by our guest today, Mr. Barclay Rey, who needs no introduction, but I will introduce him anyway. Renowned consultant, author, speaker, consistently ranked among the top 20 ITSM thought leaders, one of the architects of the ITIL V4 content guide. Many interesting things today. We're going to try to bottle it up into a brief conversation. Barclay, welcome to the show. Please introduce yourself.
Delighted to be here. Thanks very much for inviting me. And really would like to enjoy these kind of conversations and just share a few ideas and a few thoughts. As you say, I've done a variety of things, but I don't think any of them particularly define me. So hopefully we might get closer to the hub of that in this discussion, if anything defines anybody really.
So you're well known in the ITSM community. How'd you get into this space?
Bad luck, really. I think it's no good luck. I had done other things. I'd done lots of different types of work, so I'd had a life before I started, and getting into IT was actually quite, it wasn't easy, but it was, I sort of progressed quite quickly because I had some life experience and was able to move through management fairly quickly. And I had done some related things, I'd managed teams, I'd managed service and support teams of a sort before, although in a slightly different environment in the media broadcasting environment. You described me as being a technologist. I don't consider myself a technologist at all. I happen to work in this industry, but my area of interest and hopefully some experiences is really more about people and culture and those kind of things. Some people do still come up to me and say, "Oh, what do you think of this process?" And it's like, well, or this tool, great, they work. How are you going to use it? What, 99.9% of the work that I do and have done is about sorting out the people and the culture part.
Well, so along those lines, this show is about the future of work. Now, in light of an interesting, challenging past few weeks, what would you say is the future of work?
Well, if I knew that exactly, then I would be a lot better off than I am, I suppose. I think it's very. I think this period in time is really interesting because it has forced a lot of, there's obviously a very concerning period and challenging on a whole number of levels. But in 3 weeks, most of the organizations and businesses and that I know have completely transformed the way they worked, in terms of moving people to home working, virtual working, and so on. And although we've been working towards that for some time, and I've personally worked from home for 20 odd years, there's still a big hole there, which is meeting up with people and engaging and body language, and I've been calling it social continuity. We talk about business continuity, but it's the social continuity about how we interact as people and how we get things done. It's not just the tasks that we're doing, it's the stuff around it when we meet people in the corridor or when we drive to work or go for lunch or all those kind of things. So that side of it, I think, is fascinating because it's not there and we're having to find different ways of doing it. I mean, I've already joined several social conference meetings. I ran one myself yesterday where it was like, just people that I know joined and we didn't really talk about work, but it was a kind of a release or some way of just engaging and replacing that experience. I think there is the future. It really is the challenge of one sorting out how we figure out what we're actually good at compared to the automation and the robots. That, you know, anything that they can do better, they should do better. Or we have to work through all those things. So what's the bit that we actually do really well? We've been talking about this for a long time. But then secondly, you know, with the current experience, how do we actually engage and how do we ensure that if the bit that we do well is the interaction with other humans, we make sure that we're doing it as well as we can do, given the constraints of technology, distance, and so on. So it's completely up for, I mean, we've talked about these things before, but I mean, it suddenly got incredibly intense and focused in just really a few weeks. So who knows how much it might change again in 6, 12, 18 months. It's a fascinating time, as you say.
Fascinating. Yeah, no, good perspective. So you've worked with such an interesting variety of clients over your over the arc of your career. Share with our audience something memorable, maybe a request you had from a client or something that stands out in your mind as something that was notable.
Well, I suppose I've worked with a lot of different, you know, public sector, international organizations, big corporations, quite a lot of little guys, a lot of little startups and smaller businesses, particularly in the IT space. You do deal with a lot of organizations of, you know, less than the enterprise size, and that's always challenging. I think if somebody asks me to do something really outrageous, then I'll probably propose about three times the price, so that if they either get it at, you know, and or they don't bother. I think for me, some of the notable stuff has been when, you know, people actually take, because I consider my work to be advisory most of the time, so it's when people actually do take your advice and listen. And, you know, sometimes that can take, you know, that can happen quite quickly. Sometimes it takes years. And there's one organization that's very prevalent in the world at the moment, with the current crisis, that I worked for a number of years. And it took them a long time. You know, I started out doing some work where they asked me to do something, but actually it was a bit of cronyism. The guy that commissioned it just wanted me to say what he wanted to hear. And that's probably the most challenging thing as a consultant, is when you realize that the person that's hiring you and paying you is the problem. So I've encountered that on many occasions and had to deal with it in different ways. And I teach consulting now, and that's the test I always give people. It's like, well, how are you going to tell the guy that going to write the check for you that he's an idiot, you know, and he's the problem, or she's the problem. But you know, it does work out. That particular one I was referring to, I wrote them lots of recommendations. I wrote them a plan. I wrote them a global strategy, all these things, which they all thought at the time was terrible. And it took a number of years before I was asked back, and they said, oh, this is the new boss. And he sat me down and said, you're the guy that wrote that report 3-4 years ago, actually. He said that when I took over the job, that was my Bible. That was my guide. I just followed, you know, because I didn't really know how to do this part of it. I followed it to the letter. And blimey, you know, they had done all the things, and, you know, it was palpable, the change. And all, everybody was positive, whereas before it had been a horrible environment. And that's probably one of the more notable ones. Lots of similar things like that, but it's a strange world. It's a strange business, because you're not really in the limelight. You're not sort of the hero. And people don't want to start in consultancy and come to me and say, "Oh, I've done a couple of projects and I've got experience." Great, you know, but then you have to get. It's not about you. It's about how you can use that experience to help them and make them look good. And sometimes some people struggle with that. I'm very comfortable with it if I can see, you know, one, I get paid, two, maybe I get asked back at some point, and three, it's actually working. The working bit really does stick with you when you see people standing up at a conference and going, we did this and this happened, and it hasn't just improved the service, but we've improved our careers and our jobs and our, you know, everybody's happy sort of thing.
Makes sense. So along those lines, when you first meet a new client, what are some early indicators that their process and their people are mature, you know, ready to accept guidance? And kind of then the follow-up to that is, what are some early indicators that maybe you walked into a dysfunctional organization?
Well, to be honest, and without sounding, you know, like a smart ass, when I go into an organization, and many people I know that do this as well have the same, you know pretty much in the first 10 minutes, 15 minutes, first hour, just there's so many little things, and you spend a lot of the time, the discovery time, actually justify, you know, okay, finding the data, finding the information so that you can prove it. But there are so many little signs where, you know, there's the way that do people turn up for the first meeting? Do they turn up on time? You know, are they organized? How you met and greeted, just the kind of culture that says people have respect for each other. They're, you know, that you know right away if you're working particularly for the service management people and you get some other guys coming in going, well, I don't know why I'm here. This is about the service desk. What's that got to do with me? I'm important. I'm technical, you know. And you kind of go, all right, okay, that's the culture's not. These guys aren't working together very well, you know. Whereas if they're all positive and supportive and things work and, you know, the meeting rooms are booked, it's just little things like that. But you know very, very quickly. And you then spend a lot of time backing it up more than anything else. I'd say the more that I've been doing this, it's always the same. You know right away, and you know you feel sorry for people working in those kind of difficult cultures where they're not being listened to, they're not being heard, they're not supported. It must be really disheartening for them, and that's where the task is to try and find a way to turn it around in a way that doesn't, you know, completely alienate everybody, get people on side and so on.
Yeah, those themes are universal.
You must have the same with, you know, implementing tools and so on.
Same patterns, same patterns. And like you said, you know, early on the vendor side, it's a different relationship, different conversation, but I certainly resonate with what you're saying. Now, you're one of the authors of the ITIL spec. And I know it sounds awful with my horrible American accent, but you'll have to forgive that. I think I'll try to coach myself to call it the ITIL spec. I'm sure our audience would love to know a little bit of background about kind of what is ITIL, first of all, and then maybe, you know, what are some of the ways that you've seen it used most effectively at various organizations?
Well, I mean, you know, very quick. I mean, there's lots of history and so on. It's been around for a while, but basically it's a body of knowledge. It's a collection of stories about how to you know, how to run things properly. The big thing coming out of this crisis again is about sustainability. How you know, do you have a business that, you know, most people can sell one or two projects or tools or widgets. Can they run that as a sustainable business? A lot of people can have a lifestyle of doing work. Is that a sustainable business if it wasn't that person? And ITIL primarily is a number of sensible ways of working in terms of how you manage work, how you prioritize and ensure that you're delivering what is needed. And it's always been that. It's been interpreted differently in a number of different scenarios, very often by service management people who have seen it as a kind of a Bible, and we must, you know, like a very strict doctrine, which it's not, and it never ever must be. But you know, how you provide support, how you understand what you need to deliver, the capacity, the planning, you know, all those things about sustainable working that particularly people in technology don't necessarily think about. You know, technology people are interested in technology first and foremost and are excited by that, and then they build something and then want to move on. But actually, you've got, like it is with every other industry, you've got people who are interested in trains and planes and other types of industrial innovations. But then you need people to run that stuff. You need people to, you know, to drive the trains and fly the planes and sell the tickets and hand out the G&Ts and stuff. And that's the, you know, there's an element to that where you do need people to run and support technology. Not so much to support technology, but to support other people using the technology. Service management is about supporting people and supporting business. Technology, I wouldn't say it runs itself, but, you know, technology, people understand how to do that. But actually the business part of it, the sustainable part of it, is what ITIL is about. So ITIL 4, which is the recent development, you know, we've tried to clear away a lot of the old misconceptions and misappropriations of it. You know, we've tried to ensure that people use it in the way that it's always been meant to, and that, to be honest, has always been with what we now would identify as an agile mindset. You know, use it in context, apply it in context, apply it with flexibility, think about the people that are running it, think of it as a joined up collaborative piece of work, not just a series of, you know, doctrinaire processes or routines. So, you know, we've upgraded it. It's in tune now with many of the modern practices, and that includes tools and things like RPA and AI as well. We've thought about how we function in the new world. Automation is a key element, one of the guiding principles. And more than anything, it's there to try and bring our whole industry together more in a sustainable way. So I think there's a really good future for it, because sustainability is obviously one of the key words of the moment. And with it being modernized and really, you know, best practice, we talk about that as being something that reflects what we know has worked in the past, which doesn't sit so well these days because we're always looking forward. But we have done that this time. It's not just looking back, it's actually looking forward as well. And one of the new books in the series is really at the bleeding edge. I can't say anything, you know, it's involved a number of the kind of forward thinking thought leaders around the globe in their view of what service management can do or should do, and so on. I don't feel defined by ITIL, but it's been a big part of my life for the last 2 or 3 years, and of course I want it to succeed. And I would suggest that, you know, those outside of the kind of IT service management bubble take a look at what's there in ITIL 4 now, because it is, you know, it is very much about convergence and about sustainability and inclusive with things like agile, DevOps, cloud automation, product management, you know, all those kind of things that have been floating about.
So as you're coaching leaders in the face of today's, you know, uncertainty, but also looking at, you know, on the horizon, the clouds are going to break here pretty soon. We'll be on the other side of the pandemic. What do you think the enduring impact of the situation will be? And how can service management leaders modify process and culture to take into account the parts of the new normal that will endure?
Well, I think, I mean, I'm sure you're familiar with this idea that, you know, in IT, we shout from the basement or from the, you know, about needing things done, and nobody listens until something goes wrong. And then business people go, oh yeah, well, we need that. Yeah, absolutely. So there will be an element of that, I'm sure, that, I mean, the vast majority of enterprise organizations that I know have been doing contingency planning for forever, really, one way or another. The big thing is how well they test it. And that's very variable across organizations. You know, the degree to which they test it, is it tested from a people point of view and from a simple organizational working point of view? And a lot of that has been, you know, proof of concept in the last few weeks to make it happen. I think that, I think in terms of coaching leaders going forward, the big thing is how can you manage, you know, we always want people who that can manage people and understand how to get the best out of people. So how do you do that with teams that are running virtually? You know, that you're not, there's so many things that I think that you might miss opportunities. And as an example, and as a manager, I've always, you know, used marginal activities, you know, rather than standing up in a meeting and going, this is terrible, don't do this, I hate you all, you know. You take people aside and you find opportunities to sit down with people and work through what the issues are and how they can work better. And it's, I don't think that, you know, this virtual, you know, facing each other in our homes is the best time or way of doing it. I'm sure there's a better way of doing that. But when you're actually physically working with people, you have opportunities to do that. You can go and have a drink. You can go and have lunch. You can go and sit in the corridor somewhere. You can go and take a walk outside. Or, you know, the classic one is where you have to go on a journey or you have to go on a trip with people. And so you're physically very close to them for a few hours or even a couple of days. And that is where you build a relationship. And that's where you can deal with some of the, you know, you've got time to work through things. If it's, well, I'm going to do my review with you now and, you know, you've been terrible this year because your numbers aren't very good, that's going to be really challenging. So people that are able to manage that, you know, without it having to mean that they're constantly traveling everywhere, and it's been a challenge for a while, but I think that the good management skills of, you know, how you communicate with people, how you motivate them, how you motivate them to improve. So not just telling them they've done bad, but being able to get them to want to improve and not just, you know, beating them up with a stick, but this is how you could do this better. And, you know, we talked about storytelling. We need to find ways of building that into what we're doing because we're in danger of digitizing everything too much now, I think. I don't know whether once this is over, whether there'll be a bounce of people wanting to go back and do more physical working together. I think there will be, because I know even after 2 weeks and talking to people, everybody's going, we're bored, we're cabin fever, we want to get out, we want to talk to people. So that whole aspect of how people interact, I think is going to be a real challenge.
Yeah, well said. So I know it feels like we're just getting started, but I think I have time for one more question, then we'll have to wrap. And I want to make sure I could shoehorn this one in. So you're talking to the next generation of business leaders who I know would love to hear from you. What is your advice to a younger version of Barclay?
Oh, stick with music, you know, which is where I started. No, I mean, I think, you know, finding something that you like and that you're good at is always a good thing. I enjoy what I do, have done for many years, and that makes such a difference to motivation. But I suppose it is about, you know, seeing if you're working in technology, you have to have a business head on you. You have to understand, you know, people and motivation as well as technology, and vice versa. You know, you can't just get away with being a people manager only. Thinking about sustainability, I think, are really important. How do we make sure that what we're doing is repeatable, is consistent, and then we add in flexibility and we add in, you know, innovation and so on. But, you know, no, not to be too sidetracked by all the kind of glossy, this is the next big thing stuff that, you know, I had a very good manager mentor when I was 25, 30, and much of what I learned from him I still use and is still completely relevant, and is relevant in Agile and DevOps and other contexts still today. So it's not to be too sidetracked by shiny things, I suppose. So that was supposed to be a short answer.
Insightful, full of insight. Well, had I known that you were a musician, I would have had you play us out. Maybe next time you'll regale us with your musical prowess.
Or maybe not.
And do you sing? Do you play an instrument?
I play piano, keyboards, and drums. I was a drummer, but I was a professional musician for about, 10 years full-time and probably about near 20 full and part-time. So,
Barclay, this has been fantastic. Thank you. Thank you for joining us. For everyone listening, I encourage you to follow Barclay on Twitter, twitter.com/BarclayRae, R-A-E is his handle. Expect another interesting conversation with him in the future. Hope you learned something today. Thank you so much for joining us, Barclay. Excellent having you.
My pleasure. Thank you very much, Dan. Speak to you soon.